Here in Orlando, Florida, O-Town Compost is leading the composting revolution, recycling organic waste into a nutrient-rich resource. Join Charlie Pioli, founder of O-Town Compost, as we hear from the nation's leading voices behind the grassroots community composting movement. Welcome to the Community Composting Podcast.
Please rate and review on whichever podcast platform you're listening to. If you feel like this is good content and you're learning a lot about composting.
Welcome to the Community Composting Podcast, episode number 5. Here today, we're interviewing Xander Shaw at the Red Hook Community Composting site in Brooklyn, New York, Red Hook section of Brooklyn. Xander is one of the managers of the Red Hook Composting site, which is a key piece of food waste recycling infrastructure in the city. And Xander, how long have you been doing it? What kind of got you into the community composting movement?
Yeah, thanks, Charlie. We're really proud to be here in Red Hook. And yeah, we offer an awesome service for diverting food scraps away from the landfill and creating compost for local residents. But also we serve as a huge educational opportunity for folks to come down and learn about composting and take those skills back to their own backyard. But we've had also folks come and learn from our operations and build compost sites around the world too. So I've been doing it for about 3 years here at Red Hook. I was introduced to the site when I worked for a nonprofit called Grow NYC. Grow NYC picks up food scraps from local residents and brings them to composting sites. So I got to bring some food scraps here. I met the manager, Domingo Morales, and when there was a job opportunity in spring of 2018, I was able to apply for the job and ended up working here for about a year. And so I started by working here, and then for the past couple of years, I've been a volunteer consistently and been leading volunteers ever since July, full-time here. I've been the primary manager on site.
And to be clear, Red Hook Composting Site or Grow NYC, they're nonprofits. They're not for-profit businesses, correct?
Yeah, for sure. So New York City is unique in that we don't have a really functioning citywide municipal compost collection. So it's very hard to have the city come and get your compost at your curbside.
Or at least not anymore. Sorry to interrupt you, but
no, not at all.
I know that New York City Department of Sanitation had a curbside organics bin that was rolled out to about half of the city's residents, single family residents. But I think that was shut down for good after the coronavirus kind of put a pinch on the city funding. That means that what you're doing is kind of one of the last bastions of food waste recycling in the city. Is that right?
For sure, right. And so it creates a unique opportunity for grassroots organizations to fill that role when otherwise there might not be the opportunity for them to thrive as much. It's like when you can't recycle your food scraps and your organics through the city, well, there's opportunities for folks to do that at a community scale, and there's more opportunities for small businesses to arise. But it's a little bit of like a silver lining within a really troubling situation because, you know, you're right that it was oriented around the pandemic, and they claim that it's only quote unquote suspended. When they talk about curbside collection, they say, oh, it's, you know, suspended until further notice. But really the city's commitment to these programs has never really been consistent, and it's never really been really enthusiastic. And so in the absence of that enthusiastic commitment to composting by the city, community composting in New York is really thriving and very much alive. And the benefits of community composting is that we're just much more locally based, and we're able to provide an educational opportunity and a community building opportunity, as well as doing all the work that composting does, which is beneficial in its own.
Right. Like, you know, for example, Red Hook is accepting all the food scraps from the nearby Brooklyn neighborhood, whereas the curbside composting program that stuff was being, you know, trucked to facilities such as Staten Island and maybe like New Jersey, upstate. But yeah, could you just kind of, are you also part of the other community composting sites in New York City, such as Big Reuse and the Botanical Garden?
So my history is with Grow NYC, who only collects food scraps. And then I worked for a year at Red Hook Compost Site. Then I worked for a year at Lower East Side Ecology Center, which is a Manhattan-based community composter, and was operating their site for a while. The difference between Red Hook and Lower East Side primarily is that Red Hook is all hand-powered composting. So there's no machines on site at all. It's all hand tools and solar power and some wind power providing some electricity, but no fossil fuels are burnt on site. We have no machinery. It provides the maximum opportunity for volunteers to be the people moving that compost around. Mm-hmm. But at Lower East Side Ecology Center, and now I work with Big Reuse, these are compost sites that have skid steers and machine-powered mechanisms on site as well. And so after Red Hook, yeah, I got to be in touch with composters who were using machines and learn how to compost at that scale and with that technology. But also constantly, you know, using the skills that I learned at Red Hook to integrate more volunteers safely into community composting process, even when there is machines, and try to involve the community as much as possible, despite there not being that necessity that comes from composting with hand tools only.
I think that's really impressive that you guys are able to, how many tons of feedstock when you guys were operating at full scale, how many tons of food waste were you able to bring in each week?
So we would process, you know, each week, it would probably be around 8,000 pounds of material per week. And yeah, that comes out to
4 tons of food scraps per week. I mean, that's like twice what I'm doing here in Orlando right now. But to just imagine that that's all volunteer driven and you guys are using hand tools, no machinery, you know, what is the secret to getting a steady supply of volunteers? And then not only that is, you know, making sure that, you know, you're putting them to work and you're not like having people step on each other's toes, but you know, you don't have people just lazing about. So what is the secret to that?
Yeah, Charlie, that's a really great, insightful question, especially about like the making it so that people feel productive when they're not kind of standing around on site. I feel like there's a lot of outdoor volunteer activities that make it so that, you know, there's a lot of people there, but there's oftentimes not a lot to do. And people are like looking around, looking for something to do. But we really pride ourselves at Red Hook, you know, valuing volunteers and their experience. All of that volunteer ethic, though, it really stems from a guy named David Buckle. David Buckle was really conscientious around volunteer management and lots of details that go into creating a high quality volunteer experience. There's a video on YouTube that I can send you the link to. That way you might be able to put it into the show notes. But David Buckle speaks for a good amount of time about all the thought that goes into prepping for volunteers, how to safely host volunteers in a way that's rewarding while they're here, and then a couple of things that we do before they leave. So, you know, so we're making sure that all the tools are available for folks. We have really high quality tools that are comfortable to work with. We make sure we have clean gloves, and we make sure of water and boots and clothing, like some rain gear for folks, whatever might need to be used by volunteers to stay comfortable. But also, it's more sort of community building considerations. Like we pair people with partners always. We don't have folks working alone, so the folks can share in that experience and speak with each other and meet someone new who lives in the neighborhood. And at the end of the day, we always make sure to come together into a circle and touch on every single task that happened throughout the day, because sometimes, you know, we have a 20,000 square foot site. So we'll be at opposite ends of the site doing really important tasks, but you might not check in with each other to fully understand what your partner did that day. So at the end of the day, coming together, circling up, talking about how many tons of compost was turned or how much material was put into a new pile or all the other sort of special operations we do, it's fun to coalesce at the end, recognize every single task,
and then have this cheer at the end that gets everyone to leave the site with a really sort of high energy. Yeah. And we hope that that stays with folks. And we think it is the reason why, you know, at our highest peak, we were hosting 2,300 volunteers every year. So that's a good amount of folks coming through. And a lot of them are return volunteers. Those return volunteers end up taking up leadership roles in the future too, which is also crucial and rewarding.
Wow. That's really impressive. And I think David Buckle has since passed away. So I'm going to pour one out for him tonight when I have a beer. But that's pretty amazing that you guys also turn your win rows by, you know, Pitchfork, and you just utilize a number of volunteers. And I've seen a video online, you kind of have like a rotating system. Another person will kind of shovel the win row to kind of break it up, make sure it's nice and loose for the assembly line of volunteers to come in and like scoop it out to turn it. I think,
yeah, it's called the spin cycle. Absolutely. Yeah, it's a woman named Jody who taught David that. She was knowing that David was working with volunteers, and the community composting is all about just sharing these skills. So David learned from a fellow composter that if people sort of are pitchforking the material to make it loose, because shoveling directly into a windrow, there's too many wood chips, it's too compacted, it's not easy to get a shovel in there. But if you pitchfork it first, that's providing a first level of aeration, and it's loosening the material for folks to come behind in that line, like you mentioned, where you're each following behind another. That way you're not going to run into each other with the shovels. Yeah, there's lots of these little tasks and tools that we use to keep volunteers productive, but also safe and happy. Yeah.
And do you guys, you know, bring in volunteers from NYCHA, the public housing complex there? Do you have any relationship with them?
Yeah, so we used to partner with a group called Green City Force, which is an AmeriCorps program, which trains local residents living in public housing, which is called NYCHA, New York City Housing Authority. And so NYCHA residents who are within the ages of, I think it's like 17 to 22, and they don't have a college enrollment and they're not currently employed, Green City Force says, like, if you fit those qualifications, you're perfect for this program, and we're going to give you direct job training in green jobs, which is awesome. So it's like solar panel installation, compost site operation, urban farming, a breadth of different types of urban sustainability work. Green City Force trains those folks. So we used to partner with them. My mentor and the previous site manager, Domingo Morales, trained through Green City Force, and that's how he got involved with the compost site. He was David Buckle's mentee for a long time, and so after David Buckle died, he was able to take over the compost site as a manager, and he's trained people like me and my coworker Akmos, and we're both professionally composting because of that lineage of mentorship, and really it's their operations that have been able to keep it going, and it's really impressive work, right?
Yeah, I mean, when I think of New York City, I think of such a rich history in waste, mostly, you know, with their garbage, and, you know, New York City was one of the first cities to, like, look at garbage as a sanitary issue and bring in you know, the Department of Sanitation, who, by the way, they dress, they're like an army, you know, they are able to service 8+ million residents, and they're in uniforms, so they look like soldiers. But that's really interesting to hear, is like the community composting movement in New York City also has a rich lineage, and, you know, we hope that you can pass that knowledge down to some of these volunteers who are coming out of the Red Hook program.
Absolutely. Yeah, and we're happy to be able to collaborate with folks like yourself, too, who are starting operations that are community-based and really awesome all over the country and all over the world. It's great to connect online with folks and share these skills and share these experiences. Yeah, it's very valuable. I'm definitely glad to pass it on. And our connection with the community comes from Green City Forests, which are where those are paid employees and those are interns. But also anyone who wants to learn about composting locally is able to come down. And a lot of those folks are local residents. You're right.
Believe me, I've definitely kind of looked at the Big Reuse composting site. It's a composting site that does like 15 tons a week of food waste.
Mm-hmm.
They're under the Queensboro Bridge, which
right.
you know, is in the middle of this urban setting. I didn't even think was possible because of the odors and noise, and you'd be getting complaints left and right, I thought. But with their Gore technology blanket, that's definitely tickled my curiosity. And I think what you guys are doing is amazing too. Right before this call, I saw how you're screening the compost on those those tables. Describe how you get a finished product and what happens with that product.
Yeah, definitely. And I definitely think that we are a unique operation. I should mention where, you know, the return on investment at Red Hook Compost Site isn't fully based in the amount of food scraps that we're diverting and the soil amendment that we're producing and distributing. Luckily, we have been historically a completely taxpayer funded operation, but if we had to rely on, you know, a revenue stream that's based on organics diverted, you do have to scale it up to something that is much more like the Big Reuse operation in Queensbridge. And so it's really cool to see those combinations of operations, but here at Red Hook, you know, we're really focusing on that return on investment being much more community education, sustainability work that's through community building and, that connection that comes from all the other benefits that come from volunteers engaging on site, as well as the, you know, 500,000 pounds of food scraps and organics that we divert every year. And so it is cool. And part of the process that we focus on to ensure that really high quality volunteer experience is continuing to do everything by hand, even though it is very slow. So David Buckle would talk about slow composting at Red Hook. And it's true. We would take about a year from food scraps intake, building a fresh pile, to having that material be on a sifting table. I think it might be mature in about 9 months, but with the amount of time it takes for us to move it through the entire cycle, it takes about a year. So compost moves from the front of the site, gets turned, I'd say at least a dozen times before it gets all the way to the sifting tables. And tons of trash has been taken out throughout the process at every step of the way. When we're turning piles by hand, we have little red buckets right next to us, 5 gallon buckets. If you find pieces of contamination that are bigger than a sticker, then you put those right in. So as you know, constantly getting to a clean product, a clean compost pile is challenging and it takes attention to detail. When I'm working with machines, I don't always have that attention to detail, but when we're working with volunteers, we can stop and we can make sure to get all those pieces out. Right. So by the time it goes onto the sifting table, it's pretty clean. We have 1/8-inch screen that is on top of these tables. We dump unsifted compost, which has wood chips, food scraps, wood shavings, leaves, coffee chaff, a whole bunch of carbon-rich and nitrogen-rich material. That's what goes into these piles. And what comes out is sifted compost down to 1/8-inch. And what stays on top is what we call the overs, leftovers, the bulkier bits like leftover wood chips and anything that hasn't broken down to smaller than 1/8-inch. And on our sifting tables, we're able to create 2 distinct products. We have sifted compost, which comes down below the tables. We have wheelbarrows that are able to collect that material. And then we can make sure that that gets used as soil amendment. And then what's left on top, those overs, we're either going to reuse those in new compost piles, or we're going to distribute those as a mulch. So some folks like to do street tree care events or taking care of local street trees by mulching them with our composted overs, or we'll be able to use those on the farm somewhere where we need to mulch a pathway, or it's great to use those as another ingredient in compost piles to in sort of inoculate new compost piles with those microorganisms that are dormant on those overs, right?
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, that's interesting to hear about David Buckle's approach to slow composting. You're right about, you know, someone like myself who our whole goal is to bring in material and get it off site as quick as possible because we have a limited amount of room to work with. But I mean, and also with the overs, that's a different approach to kind of view it as a valuable mulch. Usually in my overs, that's where I get a lot of contamination and some compostable bags that don't fully break down.
Right.
But, you know, you guys have the labor force that can really put a fine-tooth comb through it. And where does the fines, the finished product that's been sifted,
right,
donate that or sell it?
Yeah, so luckily, like I mentioned before, we have a complex and unique situation going on here where, you know, the NYC Compost Project is taxpayer funded. And so if you get a grant from the NYC Compost Project, you know, Big Reuse is a local nonprofit that gets a grant from DSNY, called the NYC Compost Project. It fully funds the composting operations, and those are tax dollars. So part of the requirements is that you only accept material from local residents. No businesses can participate. And those who you can accept material from, you can also distribute compost to. And so if you're a local resident who has a garden, we can give you finished compost for free. But if you're a local greening operation or a community garden, if you're not a commercial operation, we'll totally be able to supply you with the soil amendment that you need. And so it's another thing that's lucky about composting in New York. If you need, or actually growing things in New York, if you're a local New York resident and you need compost, like, you have this awesome, high quality, free access to compost that, as you know, Charlie, it's like the smaller scale you make compost, like, usually the higher quality it is, because you can pay more attention to it and be really careful about balancing it. So New Yorkers have this great access to it. It's all for free. It's all through taxpayer dollars. And you're right. It makes it so that we can have that attention to detail and be able to keep it on site. And I totally feel that about the overs. You know, it's like when I'm working with machine operated sites, I've managed a machine operated site for about 2 years now. It's extremely challenging to have the attention to detail that decontaminates your feedstock, whatever you're taking into your piles, to a level where when you sift or when you screen, you have overs that aren't flooded with contamination. And so part of what I've been able to take to other compost sites, like the Lower East Side Ecology Center, is like really decontaminating early into the process. And if you do that consistently, especially with 3 or 4 people involved, over time you'll see the level of decontamination really fall to the point where you should probably be able to distribute your overs as mulch and not have folks complain too much about it being contaminated.
Yeah. I think from a taxpayer's perspective, that is like incredible. You think about normal taxpayer, the New York City is paying like $2 or $3 billion to waste management to get rid of the trash outside the city. And, you know, they're loading it onto the barges, they're loading it onto rails and just getting it out of the city. But if your taxpayer dollars are spent on recycling this food waste in one of these community composting sites, not only are you keeping, you know, you're not paying a whole ton to manage a significant portion of the waste, but you also have the opportunity to get back something from it. Unlike, you know, your trash, which you're just waving goodbye to it forever. So I think that's a
absolutely
interesting perspective. And I kind of want to shift the conversation to like the city's waste management problem as a whole. I know your boots on the ground there, and you're experiencing firsthand that the city kind of pulled the funding on these community composting sites. If you were Catherine Garcia, the chief of sanitation, what would be some policies that you would implement?
Yeah, so I gotta give credit to Catherine Garcia. She's actually been an advocate for composting in a way that not all sanitation commissioners have been. And she, you know, it's fortunate and unfortunate. Right now, she's running for mayor. So if you're in New York City and you're voting for mayor, like, yeah, support Catherine Garcia. In my opinion, speaking as a volunteer, she needs to, you know, get on board with some things like that are more progressive policies around things that aren't composting. But when it comes to composting, boom, she's like totally on board. It's just getting the rest of sanitation culture and the rest of New York City culture on board for those big changes. I think a perfect representation of the way in which they're not totally bought in is it's like, you know, New York City, as far as I know, is the only major municipality that had composting that shut it down or defunded it during the pandemic. Everywhere else kept their programs. They see them as essential and they see them as non-negotiable. And also it's like anyone who knows about the economics of these environmental programs, like consistency and dedication to these programs is the only way we're going to get the long-term economic benefit of recycling and composting. So New York City's bailing on those programs when the pandemic came around is kind of like, I wasn't very surprised. I was like, yep, you know, you guys have never really been fully dedicated to these programs. And it's been a huge challenge to do that. You know, they suspended recycling after 9/11. You know, whenever there's a big catastrophe in the city, as legitimate as those emergencies are, it seems to be a reason that recycling and composting get suspended. And those programs really thrive with consistency. If you've lived in New York City for the past 15 years, you've had to like research every 6 months if you're composting properly or if you're recycling properly. Because all these programs or these rules, they change so much with this lack of dedication. And so I would just try to commit to consistently growing funding and operational capacity for composters all over New York City. Mm-hmm. I think I love community composting. It's what I'm going to try to do for most of my career. And I really value it as a community benefit. But there's no way we can compost all of New York City's food scraps at a community scale. We need to have that larger municipal scale. And so that's only going to come with consistent funding. You don't even need to like increase funding every single year, just don't defund it anymore. So yeah, I think Catherine Garcia was commissioner, she'd still be on board for that, but she's running for mayor, so she had to step down, and other commissioners, they're not as bought into keeping this program going.
If you enjoy the Community Composting podcast and want to support future episodes, please follow the link in the episode show notes to give a small monthly reoccurring donation, even if it's $5 to $10 a month. We'll continue to come out with killer content to keep the grassroots movement rolling.
Yeah, I think you're right about consistency. Like, I actually worked on the 2017 waste characterization study there in New
York.
That's
right.
So I toured the recycling plant, Sims in Brooklyn. And mm-hmm. They were actually talking about switching from dual stream recycling to single stream. And New York City's been doing dual stream since the inception of their curbside recycling program. I just thought that it would be a huge mistake if they switched it up on the residents. And they would likely see these super high contamination rates up in the like 20% range. But yeah, I mean, I think like I was wondering what would Xander do if he was, you know, the chief of sanitation? Like,
oh yeah.
Like what kind of, how would you build the infrastructure in New York City? It sounds like most boroughs have a community composting site, but would you make it more robust in certain areas?
I definitely would. I think utilizing parks land to have community compost sites that involve volunteers is a huge way to just do massive scale education. That's extremely like beneficial. So like I said before, anyone who comes and volunteers at a compost site is going to walk away with a lot more information about how compost is made and how important it is or how cool it is. And so that is the most effective way to do high quality outreach. And because it's like you're also diverting food scraps at the same time. So it's only like, you know, 500,000 pounds of material at each medium scale site. But if you have more and more of those, that's going to add up, and you're going to build this culture of understanding around composting that is crucial. So yeah, I would definitely like, I would increase the budget for NYC compost projects. You know, the bureaucracy of land management in New York City is very challenging. A lot of New York City composters are running up against maintaining permission. You know, like right now at Red Hook Compost Site, we're technically on pause. We can't take more feedstock right now, and we don't have any full-time staff because we don't have any paid staff at all because we're waiting for permission from the Parks Department to continue operations. So it's a lot of bureaucracy that prevents us from thriving. But if we were able to secure more permission, there's lots of land in Prospect Park and in Central Park in Manhattan, all over, that could be utilized for community composting. But like I said, it's not going to be able to divert 100% of the food waste. I think,
I would love a community composting site right on like Park Ave at the beginning of That would be so cool because like all these tourists and, you know, wealthy billionaires who live there in high rises, they would start to, you know, they would be neighbors of the community composters, and that would be so cool.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that's unique about Red Hook is that, you know, we really focus on being good neighbors. We're really hyper oriented around like high quality compost, best management practices on site should make it so that you don't have smells that are going to bother your neighbors. Like active compost piles, they'll smell a little unique, but if you're balancing it right, in our opinion, Domingo Morales is pretty stringent about this. He's like, compost should not smell. If your compost smells, it means that you have in sort of an improper balance of nutrients. So you got some, you got some anaerobic conditions. And so it's like, you know, I'll be on some compost sites that do smell, but I know that there's always improvements to be made there. And yeah, when you're around those neighbors, it really holds you to a high standard of like, nope, we have a responsibility to not get complaints here. And if we're going to do that, we're going to have to implement, you know, what I call the David Buckle and Domingo Morales method, or Red Hook Compost Sites, best management practices. So yeah, I think that'd be cool. But pairing those expansions in community composting with like a South Korea method of organics diversion. Are you familiar with what South Korea is doing to divert the organics?
I've heard a little bit about it, but it sounds like each block or neighborhood kind of has a centralized location where the South Korean people can bring their food scraps, kind of like a drop off. And they're also, there's a financial incentive where they're charged per pound, I believe, for any like food scraps that are going in the trash.
Yeah, so there's those incentives built in, which is great. I think balancing these incentives is challenging because we don't want to like unintentionally harm low-income people in the country and make sure that they're not sort of like getting punished for a asymmetry of information. If you don't know about composting and suddenly there's this mandate and you get charged with that, I don't want that to happen. But ultimately, I think you're right that these incentives, they, when they're balanced right and done conscientiously, they provide this motivation for folks to compost, for sure. I shouldn't even say to compost, because the point about South Korea is that they're just diverting organics, and only like there are diversion away from landfill of organics is really impressive. It's, I don't know the exact statistic, but it's above 80%, and it's, I think, upwards close to 100%. And the important distinction there, though, is that they're not composting all of those food scraps. They're giving a lot of it to livestock. So if you're able to feed organic material, especially food scraps, to living beings that aren't microorganisms, like that's an even better thing to do besides composting. Like give it to livestock, give it to hungry people before you give it to a compost site. And South Korea does that really well. So they don't have great community composting. I met someone from South Korea who was really excited to be able to volunteer at a compost site. But also I was able to talk to them and just express how impressed I was that their country had the technology and infrastructure to give those valuable nutrients that were grown on farms to livestock first, to people, and then as a last resort to compost sites.
Yeah, that sounds like the United States back in the 40s and 50s, when that was a common practice to have farmers come in into the urban areas and haul out food scraps. And yeah, that's definitely an important component of the food waste recycling infrastructure. And as you know, like on the food waste recycling hierarchy, that is actually above composting. But I think, you know, that New York City, like at that point, it becomes kind of like a change in culture, like Korea has. And right. New York City, as you know, is so diverse, full of different people from different backgrounds and cultures. That would be an amazing thing to like bring all these cultures together. And it would save taxpayer dollars if, you know, the city isn't paying for these giant contracts with the waste haulers, and instead just putting that funding into the local community composters that are producing valuable, you know, compost for like the community gardens and are growing food locally. I know I'm kind of getting like giddy about the idea, and I would love to see it put into practice, but hypothetically, that sounds like the clear-cut solution for the city, especially when organic waste makes up like, what was it, 40, 50% of the waste stream, so.
Yeah, we talk about it as one third, you know, the common statistic is it's about one third of the waste stream, but it's also the heaviest material, you know? Right. And so it's really moisture rich. And so removing that from trucks like is huge and would seriously decrease, you know, that pollution that comes from all those vehicles and the activity of driving around in these low-income neighborhoods, most times where these transfer stations are too. And so that's where it comes into the environmental justice aspect of it as well. Yeah, we haven't even gotten to the ways in which, like, you know, using compost as a soil amendment is the whole carbon capture and regenerative agriculture thing too. We're just able to focus on the beginnings of the aspects of compost which are beneficial and all come with dedication for sure.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I think people, you know, that would kind of solve much of the like rodent and vector problem in New York City, because the rats are really attracted to those bags of garbage that are just lying on the curb in the back alley. You know, have you guys dealt with any rodents at your composting site? And what, like, I know that's a big issue where you're at. So,
Charlie, professional segues here. This is beautiful, man. Right into the rat talk. Yeah, dude. So, like, if people don't care about the environment at all, which is unfortunately legit, sometimes people are like, they're like, listen, I'm not an environmentalist. Like, I'm not doing it because I'm going to like solve these world problems. I'm like, all right, cool. Well, like, do you have rats in your backyard? They're like, yeah. I'm like, okay, well, if you compost all of your food scraps, your rat activity is going to go way down. They're like, oh, well, if it's going to decrease rats, like, yeah, sure, I'll compost. So it's like, yeah, man, there's like so many benefits to getting into composting that not everyone cares about, you know, the ways in which it's bringing together community or the ways in which it's sequestering carbon from the atmosphere. But, oh my God, if you're composting effectively, removing all those attractive ingredients in your compost, sorry, in your trash bags, that's going to make it so that your rat problems, whatever your pest is, goes way down. And so New Yorkers, the more we compost, the less rats we have, for sure.
And describe why composting would not attract rats to your backyard compost pile.
Yeah, for sure. So if you're properly sealing and insulating that compost pile, then you're protecting it from those rodents who might want to get in. So we have another great video about composting at Red Hook that David Buckle made, which details how to prevent rats from being on your community compost site. And it's a long video, but it's basically about keeping a very clean surface, making sure that surface is impenetrable. And so if you're have a compost bin, you want that to be on top of a paved surface or concrete. If you have it on top of soil, then it's likely that rats could get underneath it and burrow. You know, he talks a lot about not creating habitat for rodents, and there's various methods for preventing them from creating that habitat. You know, if you have a pile of leaves and it sits there for a year, you don't move it at all, it's likely that a rat could just post up in that leaf pile and live comfortably. But if you move it every couple of months and just aerate it or move it around or use it frequently, then you're going to make sure that you're not creating long-term habitat for rats. And also, we just use, you know, we use a, we call it seal, you know, lots of terminology on compost sites. Technically, if you're reading a compost book, it will be referred to as biofilter. Basically, put old compost that's pre-active on top of a new fresh pile. And so that cap or that seal, we go heavy at Red Hook Compost Site. We do 12 inches of more mature compost on top of every new pile. So that's a lot. And then we usually seal piles for three turns. So you build a pile, you turn it a week later, you seal it again with 12 inches of more mature compost. You turn it again another week later, you're probably going to have to seal it again because it still has raw material. But after about 1 month on site, that material doesn't have anything that's attractive to rats anymore. We don't longer have to seal that. We can use that mature material as seal for new piles. But man, it's a lot of work. Like, it's a lot of attention to detail and work to make it so that what David Buckle and Domingo eventually had is that we haven't had seen a rat at Red Hook Compost Site since 2014, really. Oh. Like, and it's that consistency of cleanliness and attention to detail and like best management practices that makes it so that we're preventing that rat activity from coming back at all.
I just imagine in your break room, you have a sign that says days since our last rodent.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it's something that we definitely keep in mind. And it's because we're so dedicated to it. So yeah, I think like that's the way in which we do it at Red Hook Compost. And anyone who takes food scraps out of those black bags that are on the corners of New York City streets, it's going to make it so it's harder for rats to get there. You know, that's unique to New York City. New York City, rightfully so, gets made fun of for not having any dumpsters and just putting our trash on the street to have DSMY come and pick it up. And unfortunately, you know, if we don't quote unquote containerize organics, like a rat can get into a bag super easily. But when DSMY is picking up compost, that's all that's in a rat proof plastic bin that DSMY dumps into the back, and it's not in a plastic bag like regular trash is. So theoretically, if we take all of those organics and put them into rat proof containers, like there's not going to be anything that rats want to get into in these trash bags anymore.
The paper and plastic and inert materials, so there's nothing
for sure.
Yeah, so that's really interesting. Do you guys accept meat and dairy at Red Hook?
You know, to be honest, we could, but we don't. So since we're hand-powered, we are really intimately involved with these piles. And we also, like I said, are just like hyper-oriented around rat prevention. So we get to consistent temperatures of above 150. You know, we're at 160 degrees pretty consistently at our peak temperatures. And that's the temperature you need to make sure that you're killing off all those pathogens. But we know that if we involve meat, cheese, dairy, bones, we're going to be providing more attractive stuff for rats and rodents. And it will take a little bit longer for that material to break down to the point where we don't need to seal it. And it's more likely to come along with pathogens and things that we can't, you know, I think we can guarantee, but we don't want to have to guarantee we can process well. And so all those things considered, we've only been taking vegan friendly food scraps consistently for a long time. Right. And so like for those who are really in the weeds about it, it's like, no, we get to good temperatures, but because we're hand powered and because we want to ensure rats offsite, we do the backyard standard of no meat, cheese, dairy, bones. If it's vegan friendly, we can do it at Red Hook.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, New York City is quite a case study for the way waste management has gone in this country. And like, I consider it ground zero of kind of like the community composting movement. And I hope to interview other community composters like Diego and Meredith with Common Ground, you know, among a couple others. But thank you so much for your time, Xander. And I hope you stay warm out there. I saw that you have some biofilters of snow on your piles.
We do, yeah. It's a winter wonderland over here.
Yeah, but Yeah, thanks again for coming on the Community Composting Podcast. Is there any last things you want to say?
Yeah, I really appreciate your work, Charlie. Thanks so much for reaching out and connecting these community composters from around the country to be able to share their stories and share some skills over this podcast. I know you're doing tons of work with O-Town Compost, and so the fact that you make time for this podcast just means a lot and is really impressive. And so I'm excited to speak with you more. If folks want to be in touch with me, they can find me on Instagram at Red Hook Compost. That's our Instagram handle. We're always happy to talk with folks, and you can see a little bit more about how we operate a fossil fuel-free hand-powered compost site at a medium scale. Red Hook Compost on Instagram and redhookcompostbk@gmail.com if you want to reach out and ask about what we're doing. So thanks again for having us. It was really a treat.
Yeah. All right. Take care, Xander. Bye-bye.
Bye, Charlie.
O-Town Compost is Orlando's community composter that offers full-service food waste pickups for residents and commercial businesses. Also, we do zero-waste events and sell soil amendment products and compostable serviceware on our website. We're super stoked to have a special for all our great listeners. To get your first month free of our convenient, odor and pest-free residential service, just use the promo code WESTORANGE, one word, WESTORANGE, and enter it when you subscribe. Thank you for listening.